This episode of the Beauty Industry Podcast was brought to you by Timely, the world's smartest appointment booking software helping beauty and wellness businesses better manage their time, sanity, and ability to generate revenue. Hello and welcome to the Beauty Industry Podcast, your online support community for the professional beauty industry. I am your host, founding director of Beauty Industry, Tamara Reid. Here, we are closing the competitive gap and speaking your language. This is a platform created and dedicated to the professional beauty industry, valuing community over competition. We serve to help connect you with inspiration from industry experts, expand your knowledge through educational pieces, and bring you the latest in product and technology innovation. This is Beauty Industry. Today's guest is Deb Farnworth-Wood, a serial entrepreneur and the founder of the world-leading Mediaesthetic franchise Australian Skin Clinics. Born in Kenya and raised in the UK, Deb's remarkable story is one of moving to the other side of the world to retire, only to build a $70 million business. Having spotted an opportunity to build a successful franchise model, Deb moved her family to the Gold Coast in 2007 and got down to work. She launched the franchise in 2011, and just 5 years later, she had grown the business to 60 clinics across Australia and New Zealand and reshaped an ailing skincare brand, scooping up multiple awards in the process. Deb was named Gold Coast Woman in Business of the Year in 2017 and was a finalist in the EY Entrepreneur of the Year Awards in 2016. Deb's career has been punctured by first. She was the first non-doctor to become a partner in a UK medical practice, and her group were the first non-pharmacist to own a UK pharmacy. She's also opened England's first drive-through pharmacy, a testament to her incredible vision and passion for the aesthetics industry that she continues to push the boundaries of business to this very day. Deb wears many hats, including being an advisory board chair for BITQ, founder of Ultimate Skin and Body Clinic, an advisor to the board of directors at Timely Appointment Software, and as the managing director and owner of Velour Organics. Deb and I caught up over Zoom to continue with self-isolation guidelines, and in true technology style, our connection was slightly crunchy at times. However, as you will hear, this inspiring episode was far too good to re-record, so I hope you don't mind it too much. If you've got an entrepreneurial bone in your body and you love hearing about how women in the beauty industry take their passion and make it a reality, then you will love today's episode. Here's Deb and I for Beauty Industry. Deb, welcome to the Beauty Industry Podcast.
Thank you for inviting me along.
Thank you. Thank you so much for joining us this morning. So we start our podcast the same way each week by finding out how our guests entered into the beauty industry. However, with yourself, I'd like to start a little bit pre-beauty industry because you're such an entrepreneur that I want to figure out how you even entered into our industry in the first place. So where did your career start, and then how did you make your way into the glitz and the glam that we know now?
Well, I suppose my really early career, having left school and college, was basically in the hotel and catering industry. So I had this crazy idea that I wanted to be a chef, actually, and did hotel management at college. And after that, I did probably less than a year in hotels and decided that it was no fun. Everyone else was out enjoying themselves while I was working. And the pay was rubbish and the conditions were bad. And I sort of fell into an office job with a retail outlet. And from then, I went from one to the next retail outlet. I think over the course of about, hard to remember now, maybe 6 years. But in each outlet I worked in, I had two or three jobs that seemed to get promoted really quickly. And I really enjoyed retail. And the last retail stint I had was with the Burton Group, with Debenhams. And I started off as a stores admin in one of the stores in the northwest of England, and then later moved into their accounting office down in the southwest of England. And did things like put in EPOS systems, did store openings, and kind of varied work along the way. And then I saw an advert, well, so before that, I was asked to go and work up in London in the buying offices, and I actually didn't want to go and live in London, so I started to look for another role, and I took what I thought would be a very short-term position in a GP practice as the manager, and it was at a time when the UK NHS was looking for commercial managers to come into the health service to make economies and make the health service budget stretch further. And so I was the first of a new wave of people to do that. And I got hooked and became a partner in the practice that I was in. I was the first non-doctor to be a partner in general practice, managed to get the rules and regulations about that changed. We were the first GP practice to own our own pharmacy, and then we were the first pharmacy in the UK to put a drive-through to collect scripts. So I was there for kind of 18 years and then decided to retire. Had no intentions of particularly going into beauty. But my husband wanted to retire to Australia. And so I knew the, you know, I was of an age where it was kind of just about too late to get a working visa to come here. So the only way to do it really was to invest here and buy a business. And my practice in the UK was multidisciplinary, so we had lots and lots of different services there. And we did have a small aesthetic clinic, and we did Botox and such like. So I saw the original Australian skin clinics for sale, and I thought, yeah, I can do that. That'll be easy. That'll get me my visa. Put a manager in and sit on the beach was the idea. It went kind of strangely wrong after that.
Yeah, I can imagine. I think a lot of business owners have that idea, don't they, where they see a business for sale, especially if they're not in the beauty industry specifically, and then they think, oh, I'll snap that up and go live down in Mornington or Rye and just have this beautiful, lush life. And then we realise very quickly that that may not be the case.
No, and I think really, you know, I was 44 trying to retire, and in a way, I suppose I should have known my own personality. I think that's probably one of the biggest lapses of judgments I've ever had. And I rapidly got bored and ended up going into the clinic, and then I got hooked on all the things we were doing in there. And the thing that appealed to me about that particular clinic was it was a doctor-run clinic, and it was very much a one-stop shop. So we did everything from lash tinting and waxing right through to liposuction and thread lifts. So, you know, it was quite a diverse range of services. It was a very busy business. There were, I think from memory, 14 or 16 staff at the time. And it was just fascinating. So I kind of went back in to have fun rather than necessity, if that makes sense. Mm. But also the GFC hit within a few months of me arriving here. And so I thought at the time, maybe I should spend more time there to make sure we got through the GFC, which we did, of course. And also then decided that as soon as we were out of the GFC, I'd launch a franchise. So I spent probably most of the part of the GFC actually preparing to launch that franchise.
Yeah, right. So interesting. How, I mean, A, I guess, did you ever think that you would hit another recession while you're in business, while we're in the midst of what's going on in the world now? And has it felt different for you this time around?
The first question, I think, yes, we've all felt the retail strain in the last 12 months. So I think we've all seen it coming along, but not really knowing where it's going to end. Mm. And certainly, I don't think anybody could have expected the virus. It's very different. In the GFC, businesses were still running. Yes, a lot were failing, but most were still working. And there's a lot less businesses going now. Mm. We've never had governments hand out money so readily before to keep businesses on their feet. So yeah, very different, very different.
Yeah, okay, interesting. And so in 2007 then, you purchased Australian Skin Clinics. It was quite still an early adoption of, you know, the kind of advanced cosmetical skin clinic that's doing, you know, your anti-wrinkle and filler and fat freezing, when now we've got this boom almost 10 years later. You mentioned there obviously you needed to get into the country, so it was a beautiful way for you to get in there. But what was it particularly about that brand? You know, I'm sure that there were many other businesses for sale at that time that you kind of knew that it was the right purchase decision.
Well, as I said, we all were going down that route in our business. We had a lot of holistic homeopathy and hypnotherapy, and we had, as I said, a sort of small aesthetic clinic, not as comprehensive as the one I bought here was. So I was already interested in that area, and I could also see that it was going to boom. It was just, I remembered back to a time when I was probably about 12 or 13 and my mum met me at the school gate and was chatting to a friend's mum who just had her hair done, and she spent a fortune having a perm and bleach and straights. And I remember my mum's comment was that she had more money than sense because she spent all this money on herself. And then, you know, not many years later, we're all doing that. So I kind of looked at this trend and could see that mirror happening again. Which indeed it did. So yeah, so I think it was quite, it was actually a very sound business decision, and it was actually quite calculated in the end. I think in terms of the actual clinic, what I liked about it was doctor run, and bear in mind I'd been in business for 18 years at that point with doctors, so that was an environment I was comfortable in. One of my doctors in the UK was actually a barrister as well as a doctor. So he used to do a lot of medical legal defence work. So I understood fully the kind of complexities of how you deliver a treatment and get the right consents and be safe and be legal. So there was nothing about it that was really difficult. And when it came to thinking about franchising it, because I'd worked for Debenhams is actually it's gone now, but it was a company with multiple outlets. But the principles of running multiple outlets, be it franchising or store-owned, quite similar in many respects. So I already had a lot of those skill sets.
How interesting. And so when the GFC hit and you were kind of sitting in it thinking, okay, I can see the light at the end of the tunnel. I can see that almost beauty, aesthetic, wellness is recession-proof, for a lack of a better word. And I want to franchise. I mean, in the moment where we can't see the light at the end of the tunnel, a lot of people are thinking, how am I going to hold on to my one location? And here you are thinking, completely polar opposite to that, I'm going to expand and I'm going to grow those locations. What did that time actually look like for you? I mean, how does one go from having one space and then expanding and you know, even having multiple locations versus you've got 60 clinics across 5 years that you've franchised, you know, you had rapid expansion there.
So I think it was a series of steps. The first step was everybody was talking about the GFC, worrying about the GFC, saying they had no money. The staff were anxious about their jobs. So we started out by having a sit-down meeting, at which I basically said to them, listen, we can die or we fight and live through this. And our goal has to be, by the end of the GFC, that we need to be like the big boys on the block. And so we have to stay robust and we have to do everything that we know is good for retaining our clients. And I was really lucky that we had an amazing team and we did exactly that. So I suppose that was the first side. And then that was the front picture and that was what we spoke about in the shop. But behind the scenes, I was looking at what was a very complicated clinic, and it was. We had such a range of treatments. So, for example, we had erbium lasers that would do full resurfacing but only a doctor could use. And I only had a doctor who could use that once or twice a week. So we had a lot of equipment that was really not making enough money for itself or not paying its way. And then we had the other end. We had waxing and tinting, and those were services we offered just so that ladies of the Gold Coast could come in and say to their husbands they'd had a wax or they'd had the brows when really they'd had the Botox and their fillers.
I love that.
So we but of course that meant we had many levels of staff. We had many different procedures and protocols. So we had, you know, sort of junior therapists, advanced therapists, nurses and doctors. And that was impossible to franchise. I recognised that quite early on. So set about, I suppose, reducing the numbers of services that we offered and looking for what was a sweet spot, what was the highest asked for and best paid, kind of.
Interesting. It's funny that a lot of people don't do that. You know, I think now more than ever, you've got people who are in very, very, very niche products and they're doing just the brows or just the lashes or just the skin. But then you've got, again, the opposite side to that, who people to try and they've got a million and one services, a million and one products on their range. What was that culling process like? I mean, you said the most popular services and the services that are making the most money, but sometimes, you know, we've got to still service a wax, for example, because it is like a bread and butter and we know that clients are always going to need hair removal. How kind of cutthroat did you have to be with some of the services that you knew clients were going to continue to ask for or you knew therapists love performing?
Actually, the decision was kind of made for me. We had a freak accident. We turned up to work one day and a burst pipe on the top floor of our clinic. So the clinic was 14 treatment rooms on two floors.
Wow.
And there was a burst pipe on the top floor, which completely annihilated the downstairs floor. So I literally turned into work one day to find water swimming out of the building, and my ceiling in my office was on my desk. And so we had to very quickly evacuate all the equipment upstairs to get it dry, and we had to work on half the floor space. And the dry out process was about 4 months because the whole building was just completely soaked. And so in that time I had to decide who to send home because I didn't have 14 rooms anymore. And so over the course of kind of that weekend, I did an assessment of where our revenues were coming from, where the most profitability lay, and I literally did it on that basis. And so sadly we laid off some of the waxes, the tinting, we stayed with all the laser, the higher end treatments. We reduced some of the doctor end treatments, so we stopped doing so we didn't do liposuction anymore, but we still did some threads with the doctors. We just sort of remodeled in a way that it was both manageable on the size of the floor and also profitable for the business. And interestingly, those 4 months when we were on half the floor space, we traded 45% up on the previous year. Mm-hmm. And one of the things I attribute to that was the fact that we had everybody in a small waiting space. And so quite often we didn't have a room to do a consult in, so we were consulting in the waiting room and we were almost having consultation parties. It was really, really amusing, and the clients loved it. They liked to hear what we were talking about. You'd get the odd one who'd ask for privacy, but in the main, most of our consults were done quite publicly.
Yeah, incredible. Okay. They do say that 80% of your revenue comes from 20% of the output that you do, isn't it?
Yeah, it's exactly right. And it costs as well.
Yes. As a product rep myself, I used to actually service some of the Australian skin clinics under the brand of Skinstitute, which I work for. So I completely understand the Ozskin model. And what I saw when I went into Ozskin, apart from any other businesses that I had serviced, not only in Skinstitute, but in my previous role as a beauty therapist, manager, et cetera, were the protocols. And as a detail-driven person myself, I was opening up these Ozskin protocols going, oh, it's like the holy grail of skin treatments. I was so, so, so excited. In our industry, I think it's super difficult to get consistency from one therapist to another in the different rooms, let alone having this consistency that your brand had across states, across locations, you know, across the country. How did you, I mean, everybody says create policies and protocols and you've got the Bible and you've got the book, but how do you actually get people to fulfill that and to keep on with that autonomy, not just to start mixing bowls and treatments and products as per whatever they wish that day?
It was tricky actually. Because I came from a health background, that's very much the way health operate. They have a protocol and a procedure, and they have a checklist, and you follow that and you don't deviate from it. So I came into it quite conditioned, expecting everybody to jump on board and think this was great. And yes, it was challenging. One of my biggest problems was actually the extras that people do, that they don't value their time, but they wanted to do extras. So we'd often find, you know, certain staff would overrun every single appointment and the client would come out and you could see they'd had treatments in areas that weren't recorded on the system and they hadn't booked in from. And I'd say that throughout that time and still to this day, that's one of the hardest things to move, is the, in some ways, therapists never really value their time. It's like they feel they've got to ingratiate themselves with the client and offer that bit more. And I'm all for customer service and I'm all for offering that bit more, but in a structured way, not in a way that it devalues your service and makes you lose money and not be profitable.
Yeah, that's so true. I know I've looked at many, many businesses kind of treatment menus and how they are, you know, making most money off their service menu. And I've sat in a lot of therapist treatments as well. And you sometimes see, you know, an added shake of hyaluronic or, you know, a bit of vitamin C here, or I'll just quickly add on this mask. And I think that the therapists sometimes don't understand too, that that one shake could be an extra $1.65. And if you're just doing an extra shake three or four times during the treatment, that's an extra $5. We add that up by 10 clients, that's $50 a day. Do you know what I mean? And I think sometimes as well, as business owners, we shy away from showing therapists figures and all of the kind of profit and revenue that's coming into the business. But sometimes if they don't know why we're saying, well, don't add that shake of XYZ product in, they just think sometimes maybe we're micromanaging them or we just like to be a little bit bossy, but it all comes down to the final dollar.
Yeah, it's exactly right. And I've always been very transparent about the costs in my business. I think there's two sides, really. I think sometimes the staff, when you learn beauty therapy, you don't learn business. You learn how to treat a client. And so I feel they leave school right now with not enough information about running your business, and certainly not enough. You know, some of them that leave school now can't even shake hands and talk to a customer because most of their learning is online. So there was, even back then and still now, there was a lot of time taken to teach them to do the treatments the right way, but you still get mavericks. So, you know, over the years, we've had to let a lot of mavericks go because they're a risk to our business, where they've not followed the protocol, they've not got the consent form signed, they've not completed notes, you know, they've left their business open to risk. And then in terms of the actual use of products, yeah, the extra shake into the client bowl is one problem, but the extra bottle that goes in the handbag and goes home is another problem. And, you know, we see not just from staff, but clients as well. Staff leave clients on their own in a room and things go missing. Theft is rife in the industry, and it's not often spoken about, and it's actually quite sad, but a lot of clinics struggle to make a profit, and even more so when there is theft in the building, whether it's by clients or staff. And then I think there's also to fight with is the culture of everybody seems to want something for nothing. So, you know, you're already discounting because the next clinic down the road's discounting, and then now we're discounting and we're trying to give them an extra discount as well to try and keep them. And, you know, maybe the one thing that will come out of this recession is that while everybody's off, everybody's looking at their profitability and looking at where their revenues come from. Because I know time and time again when I talk to clinic owners and salon managers, so often they actually don't know their overhead costs. Because unless you do have a protocol that says, well, put a pea size of scrub on to scrub the face, you haven't costed out what your scrub is costing you. And so, you know, one of my hopes, the people have been calling me and saying, Deb, what shall I do? I'm saying to them, just look at every aspect of your business now. Look at your profitable treatments. Look what's not profitable. And look where your wastage is, so that when you get back in, you're fighting fit shape to start again.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more. And the price wars between one another, that I'm hoping once we get out of this, it does stop, because we know that clients have now their internet open. They've got a million browsers open, and it's our fault, to be honest. We have created the culture by which they phone up and say, how much is a half leg and Brazilian laser hair removal, for example? And we confuse them. We say, oh, well, it's normally $79, but today it's 40% off. And that comes down to this. And if you purchase six, then you get the seventh one free and da, 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 da. And we're doing all of these equations, and the client's like, hang on, so how much is it? And we just give them a final price. Now, what they do is they shut that browser down, and the next person they call and the next person they call, we're all just giving them that, you know, that race to the bottom. So then we are encouraging the client to go for the cheapest treatment. We're not actually saying what's unique about our space, why we're different, why we charge as much as we do. It is just a price war. So I'm hoping that once we do reach the other side of this, we kind of realize many things, you know, what our break even is and what our services cost. After the break, Deb shares with us how she ensures consistency across 60 clinics, her role within Timely, and lets us in on her newest venture into men's skincare. But first, a word from today's Beauté partner. Community, you know all too well how pro I am about all things online booking and working smarter, not harder in 2020, and our friends at Timely help you to do just that. Timely is a powerful booking and business management software for businesses of any size and ambition. Designed to help you save hours on admin, deliver exceptional client experience, establish a much-loved brand and grow your revenue with over 500 software updates every year, Timely is always on a mission to help you get the best from your business. Timely works beautifully with Tyro, Xero, QuickBooks, MailChimp, Square, Google Calendar, and more. So why not join over 40,000 global Timely customers today? If you've been thinking about making the switch from pen and paper or want to test a new salon software system, visit www.gettimely.com to start a free 14-day trial. The Timely team has an exclusive offer for the listeners of today's episode where you get 50% off Timely for your first 2 months. It's such an incredible offer by using the promo code TAMARA20. That's Tamara and the number 20. Thank you so much to the team at Timely for making this episode possible. And now back to Deb. I'm wondering, were you ever worried about the franchising process diluting the services? Or, you know, as such a control freak myself, I don't know if I could ever franchise anything because I would just be so nervous to my core that it wouldn't hold the same essential service that I put into it.
It was definitely an anxiety. And to overcome that, I had to satisfy myself that I had the right steps in place. And so we came up with a very strong training regime. So, for example, every new member of staff had to do 2 days induction with the head office, and they would go through all the procedures and treatments relative to their or relating to their particular position. We audited. We had an audit manager in the head office who would audit the notes and the records and make sure that they were all done. And it was a huge focus. And I think, you know, when I compared at the time when we were growing, when I compared the size of our head office staff with similar brands, we had a much larger organization to make sure things happen safely. And again, that was definitely the health service background in me. And I'd seen, you know, way too many problems, some people not doing things right. We also had, you know, quite religious, vigorous follow-up. So if we found someone was treating outside of protocol, then, you know, they would be met with and spoken to, and the franchisee concerned would have to address that.
Yeah, okay then. On to a more exciting note, because earlier in 2019, you were actually announced as a director for Timely Appointment Software. And this, you know, is alongside some incredible names like Tabitha Coffey, we've got Mike O'Donnell. Why the move from service-based industries into software? I mean, I know they're quite intricately linked, but what can we expect to see from Timely with your input as well?
Well, I think back in my retail days, I was involved in putting in FPOS systems before they were a thing. So when I started in retail, for example, we still had the Access chunk machine where you went over a piece of paper with your card. So I was involved in putting EPOS in and stock management systems, and that was some of the work I did with Debenhams. So I've always had quite a passion for IT. Actually, even when I worked at Debenhams, none of us had a computer to work on, but I bought myself one and I had it on my desk that I paid for myself so I could be more efficient. So even growing the franchise, I was pretty IT obsessed. So I knew what KPIs I wanted to monitor. I knew what reports I wanted to see. And at the time, no software provided what I needed. So I actually worked with the software company that we had at that time to develop the software to be able to manage my business. And so when Timely approached me, and I think they probably didn't even know about my IT background and my obsession with numbers, but they kind of knew what I'd done with the brand, and they, you know, they knew that I'd left the brand, I'd sold Australian Skin Clinics by then. So they approached me to be on their board and advise about, you know, the industry. And of course, Tabitha advises about the hair side, and I advise about aesthetic side. And so, yeah, so it's been really enjoyable. And they're, you know, an amazing company, I have to say. They're very forward thinking. Our meetings are really good fun and very creative. Yeah,
incredible. I speak with the ladies there at Timely quite frequently, actually. Lovely Malia and Steph, they're always checking in and, you know, just chatting about the industry. It's so lovely to hear how engaged they are too. You know, I think sometimes you kind of think that your salon software program is so completely external from the industry, but I love that they really understand what's going on and appreciate too that they want to know what's going on as well, not that they just have to. But something I see across both brands that, you know, are very, very similar, and I know something that you are very passionate about as well, is that culture, you know, culture and customer service and just having a passion for business in business is really something that, you know, lights you up, and it definitely lights me up as well. Can I ask, what do you think is the secret sauce in company culture? Because you can get it very, very wrong and you can get it very right. And those who get it right, we all want to be in there. You know, those are the businesses that have wait lists for people to kind of line up and get into. So what do you think that consists of?
Two key points. So number one is transparency. It's really hard for a staff member to integrate into a business, understand what they need to do, unless there's a degree of transparency. Why are you here? What is the role? What is it we expect you to do? And if not, how are we going to help you to do that? So I think that's the first side. The second is actually recruitment, is recruiting the right staff to start with. And that's tricky, and it's got trickier as time has gone on. Back when I first bought Australian Skin Clinics, if I ever advertised a post, I'd have for normal therapists anyway, if I advertised a post, I'd had probably 15 to 20 applications. Wow. Now you're lucky to get two or three. Mm. Nursing was difficult, interestingly. We struggled to recruit nurses, and that's obviously, back then there were not many injectable nurses. That's itself an industry that's boomed over the years. And turning to Timely, their sort of company philosophy is just absolutely excellent. I attended, they have an annual hoo-ha, and I attended their meeting, and I can honestly say every single member of staff is excited to know what we're doing in the industry. It's really refreshing to see.
Yeah, incredible. And especially during this time where business owners need lots of support, I've seen a lot of the resources and bits and pieces that they're putting out to just help and really be kind of a friend during this really struggling time as well.
Yeah, and it's all on their website, and they've got it on their Facebook page. All my staff have been instructed to read every single thing on the Timely Facebook page between now and going back to work, and watch all their podcasts. And yes, it's great. And actually, I have to be honest, I'm not on Timely software, but I'm going to be soon.
Ah, there you go. Interesting. And so what I'm more curious about to kind of find out and get your take on now is, you know, moving into why you've made the move into men's skincare, because that's your most newest venture. I mean, I think I mentioned in the bio, 7 times entrepreneur and founder, and just incredible. How come menswear, in terms of skincare, sorry, in the beard range, how come that has come as a blip on your radar, and where are you expecting this to kind of take off to now?
Well, I've always said in business, I think if you're good at business, you can run any type of business as long as you're interested in it. And the interest in skincare came with the turf. But I just happened to see this very niche product. It was a business that was for sale. I thought, oh, I'll have a look at that. And I just kind of fell in love with it completely, saw the products. And even though I'm not a man with a beard, interestingly, the product that really grabbed my attention was an all-natural deodorant that the brand has. So it's no nasties, aluminium-free. And I'd never used any of these products at that time. But I just had a couple of lumps biopsied under my arm. So I was really, at that time, aware of, you know, suddenly the dangers of aluminium in your deodorants. And it was, I suppose it was just a coincidence these two things happened together. And I tried their natural deodorant, and I've never gone back. And So it was for sale. I did the numbers. It's very small business compared to obviously the Australian Skin Clinics franchise, but I just was really excited. So it's all organic, mostly organic. It's 96% organic products in it. There's no nasties in any of the products. We manufacture it ourselves. We've got a manufacturing unit there where we make it. And yeah, it's just different. It's just another business. So it's exciting.
There you go. I want to come back to the word entrepreneur, because I think, you know, nowadays we throw around these phases of lady boss and entrepreneur and all of this kind of thing. But when you were kind of in the midst of moving through retail and coming up into business and these words weren't so well known, how did you kind of navigate what you were doing? You know, people must have thought you're crazy owning and looking into and working this hard, because it just wasn't really something that was as common as it is today.
Yeah, I honestly don't recall ever questioning it. I've always done what I wanted to do, and because I want to do it for no other reason. I've always been an incredibly hard worker. I actually like my job. I've never had a job that I don't like, so I've always been quite happy. There were times back in the UK, I used to do a lot of think tank works and do little projects with the Prime Minister's Office of Public Reform, looking at, you know, changes in the health service and things like that. And people used to say to me, why do you bother doing that? And I used to think, well, it's just interesting, it's just different. I never considered myself an entrepreneur. I thought Richard Branson was an entrepreneur and you had to be mega rich to be classed as that. So I don't think that terminology ever entered into my head. Whereas now you can have a market stall selling knitted scarves and you're an entrepreneur. So I think in a way the word's lost its magic. It's not often a word I use about myself. So I'm just, I have a little game with myself that every business that I get involved in has to be bigger than the last one. And so, you know, going back to the men's beardwear, and it's for men who shave and men who don't as well. You know, it's quite hard to imagine how that in its isolation could be bigger than what I'd done before. But let's just say it's a bit part of a bit bigger game plan. So you'll see a few other things emerging soon.
Incredible. Do you think it's nurture or nature, this entrepreneurial kind of spirit, go-getter, I've got to have another business that has to be bigger than the last? Has it been something that perhaps you were born with, or do you think it's developed?
I think it's a bit of both. I think part of it's work ethic, and I come from a very working class family. My mum had her own business, my stepfather had his own business, and they both worked incredibly hard. And so I think I grew up with that expectation, is that you get a good job and you work hard. But then I pretty soon realised I didn't really like working for other people. And so I think once I got the taste of working for myself, I never went back. And so I was last technically employed by someone else when I was about 26 or 30 years now, like wow, in my own businesses. There have been times when business is hard, because business is hard. And certainly the GFC, my worry was that if we didn't survive that storm of the GFC, then we'd be eating into our retirement savings. And I kind of didn't want to do that. So that probably pushed me to work a little bit harder again. When we launched the franchise, again, you've then got other people who are dependent on you. So you've got the franchisees are dependent on you and their staff are dependent on you. So I suppose that's a different trigger to make you work hard again, that you've got to look after your people. But is it nurture? Is it nature? I don't know. I think it's, for me, I just think it's a bit of both.
Yeah, I love that. And I'm wondering then what your advice is for the next wave of people who are coming up into the professional industry. I know, you know, you mentioned before, someone opens up a skincare range overnight and all of a sudden they're an entrepreneur, or we're seeing a lot of product educators and, you know, institutional educators come on out and work independently as well for themselves. What is your advice to anybody who does want to go into that self-employment, entrepreneurial kind of category?
I think my first piece of advice is there a business case for it? So I've seen over the years quite a lot of people do exactly that and fall in. You're doing a terrific job and all my staff have been on your training sessions this week, but a lot of people do fail, and really generally when businesses fail, it's because they haven't done the business case first. They haven't asked themselves, where are they going to get their customer? Why is that customer going to pay them for their service as opposed to someone else? And what are the other options out there? And then the second thing is, I think a lot of people go out with the knowledge that they have already. And, you know, even now, I'm not so old or so proud or done business for so long that I think I know it all. I'm on podcasts this week and I'm on lessons this week learning new things. And I think keeping that skill set up to date is really important. It's too easy to sit back and say, well, I've got all this knowledge now and I don't need any more, when in fact you do.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more. As somebody who I've looked up to yourself, you know, in the industry coming up and now into my own little entrepreneurship business owner hat, I'm wondering then, who do you look up to? Is there anyone that you kind of aspire to or perhaps not want to be, but somebody that really lights you up when you listen to them or read about them or see them ticking off boxes and kicking goals?
I think over the years there's been a great number of people that I could apply that to, but probably it's always, for me, it relates to what I think I need to learn at that time or what deficit I feel I've got at that time in my knowledge. So, you know, even right now, I'm actually following everybody because, you know, we're in a really unique situation. All these people who have historically been charging for their services or not even giving their information out or ordering free information online. So I'm actually fascinated just by some of the very ordinary people who are having a go and getting out there. It's really interesting. I think if you kind of, over the years, people who've influenced me have been less the kind of Richard Bransons and more the normal people. So I've had, in the days when I was employed, I had some amazing bosses who taught me a lot. When I was in business with the doctors, they taught me a lot in different ways. So I think no one person really, I just love learning and listening.
Yeah, incredible. And I haven't prepped you on this question, but I'm wondering what you think the industry is going to look like in the next 10 to 20 years. Obviously, I'm assuming with your beard range now, we're going to see the men's skincare category spike up. What else do you think is going to happen?
So it's quite an interesting time. When you look at things like laser hair removal, there's not a lot changed in laser technology. The machines might be faster and have a different cooling system or work at a different speed, but, you know, it's still the same wavelength to remove hair. So, you know, there comes the point where it's all me and same. So I think for me, what I'm looking for is new technologies that may come out there, whether we're going to see different trends in the types of treatment. I was reading someone's blog the other day, and apparently in France it's fashionable to be hairy again now, and people are growing their armpits back.
Oh gosh, I hope not.
Me too. So I think the greater concern is actually what, not really what 20 years is going to look like, but what the next two are. In the GFC, it was pretty well banded around that about 30% of beauty therapists went out of business. And although obviously we did see them all come back, but pre-GST, there were no big brands. That all happened after. So we're in a completely different landscape. We've had, I think, years of not always being able to get the high calibre staff we'd like. That's across the board. I think there's a lot of people out there who've not had what I'd call good enough training or have enough personal interest in being better. And I think there'll be, for a little while anyway, I think there will be, I suppose, a higher concentration of available therapists with good skills, because there will be some loss of employers. But I think we'll also see home workers starting again after GFC. A lot of people went back into doing beauty therapy at home rather than working for someone else. So I think we'll see an emergence of that. And I think for the bigger brands, I think we'll see more legislation coming through, more tightening of systems. I suppose more commercialization of the products. But there is no doubt we are overwhelmed with the number of businesses that offer the same services. And I think, you know, to anyone who's going into the industry now or looking to expand now, my big advice to you is don't try and copy anyone else. There's enough same. And you need to be different, and you need to be unique, and you need a different catch.
I'm actually really excited for the other side. I mean, it's scary being in it now, but on the other side, as you said, it's going to be quality businesses. We're going to have these quality therapists come back. I think the business owner is going to have a little bit more control than they previously have had. And I hope that it does inspire the kind of entitled millennial therapists who are out there thinking that they know everything. You know, I hope that it kind of gives them a little bit more grounding to educate, upskill, refine their passion, and come back ready for their clients.
I think to some degrees, the whole, you know, the whole coronavirus is going to be a new leveler. You know, a lot of these millennials, they haven't experienced hard times. They probably, you know, even the GFC was nothing of a recession compared to that of the 80s and 90s, you know, which I saw because I'm old enough to have seen that. So I think it's going to give some people a shock. You know, there are people who are going to not be able to just walk back into their job like they could before. I think standards should go up because of it. I mean, certainly my expectation of my team is that you have to be the best you can be, and second best is not good enough. And, you know, I think that's a really clear message that all salon owners should be putting out. But that's easier said than done when in days when it's difficult to recruit. So that worm is going to turn when we get back.
Absolutely. And I'm so excited to see your men's skincare range as well come out and absolutely dominate the industry. Do you think that are you going to go wholesale into clinics and beauty destinations as well, or are you going to be purely retail?
No, so we already have about 70 stockists in Australia, and we have about another 30 in New Zealand. And we've sold to a variety of outlets. So we're in a couple of beauty salons. We're in some gift shops. We're in barber shops. It's akin to a barber range. We've got some new products coming out shortly that will enhance that barber side of the range. We've just taken on a distributor in Canada. We're also in Scoop shops in Sydney and around the place. We're also in Singapore. So it's already out there. It's kind of, we've just gone through a rebranding exercise and given it a refresh and just done, given the website an overhaul to increase our online presence. But yeah, so we've got quite a range of customers, and we are more of a wholesale model than a kind of online model.
Brilliant. So watch this space. That's so exciting. I wish you all the best with that. Deb, thank you so much for spending the morning chatting with me this morning. It's been an absolute pleasure.
Thank you for having me. Sorry about the croaky voice. It's been a bit dry today. Not corona dry. It's definitely air conditioning.
That's not a problem. Thank you so much, Deb.
Lovely chatting with you. Thank you.
Thank you so much for tuning into today's episode. Deb is the woman I think many of us aspire to be. She's inspirational yet realistic and has achieved so much success to date, yet still remains extremely humble. Deb's go-getter approach to business is something that we should all put more time and energy into, especially when it comes to building the foundations of our business or platforms before wanting to expand them. If you have loved today's episode and what you have heard from Deb, make sure you show us how you're listening to this episode, whether that be at home, in your backyard, or spending time listening while you do something creative. And be sure to tag at Deb Farnworth Wood and myself at Tamara Shaw Reid and Beauté Industry so that we can see what you're up to. Being an independent podcaster means your support is the only chance we get to reach as many beauty industry ears as possible. So while you're spending time out of the treatment rooms and out of the business, if you could give us a little rating on today's episode, and if you're feeling super loving, give us a little review so that we can see your thoughts. Until next time, stay connected.